It is Saturday, July 30th, 2011. We are broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is Public Radio KUSP. Today on the show, we'll be doing geek news in the first half and the second half, your questions and comments about technology. The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI. It's time now for GeekSpeak. Welcome to GeekSpeak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during GeekSpeak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today's theme song is by Dave Portera. Thank you. GeekSpeak is Creative Commons endeavor. Share and share alike. If you'd like to participate by making a theme, please feel free to do so. You can send us it at geekspeak.org. Today on the show, we'll be taking your calls and questions in the second half. The phone number is 800-655-5877. I'll give that contact information again when I invite your participation in about half an hour. I'm Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Miles Elam. He's a software engineer and political junkie. Good morning, Miles.
Good morning.
Mr. Miles Elam, please do start out with a little bit of news from Germany, I'd hope.
Germany has recently come into the news saying that they are going to drop all nuclear power production. This has come on the heels of the Japanese Fukushima accident and years, actually, of the of anti-nuclear sentiment growing in Germany. But they are still one of the countries that strongly follows a model of reducing carbon emissions. So the question has been, how are they going to be doing this? How are they going to be able to how are they going to get enough power sources without using nuclear and still have a lower carbon footprint? Because yeah. The high-output power sources usually are things like nuclear, coal, natural gas is a relatively high one. And of those three, nuclear is the only one that doesn't emit any CO2 or other greenhouse gases. One thing they're talking about is what many environmentalists try to push for, which is energy efficiency, just trying to put measures for energy efficiency in office buildings, pushing for standards in various electronics and various aspects of life so that they can just reduce their overall power needs quite a bit. Trying to push forward more in terms of wind power, alternative energy sources, to try to bolster up at least. By lowering their energy requirements, they have a lot more options of what they can do for...
To modify that amount of usage, sure.
To
if you're using less
bring
a little
up
bit.
Their...
Right. If you're using
their baseband,
if you're using less energy, then just a little bit of additional energy goes a lot further.
Mm-hmm.
What about rivers and dams? Are they doing that infrastructure as well?
Well, dam infrastructure is a title is a one. They're not on the coast.
Yeah. Right.
And dams are one thing like in the U.S. we have dams at or power generating hydroelectric systems mm-hmm. in Niagara Falls, Hoover Dam, and okay. So these major geological features that allowed for it, and Hoover Dam is actually kind of an exception because we kind of created a new lake and flooded other areas and all that.
In any of those situations, there's definitely a major impact in creation of the system. And then the species impact continually after that.
Right. Well, Niagara Falls was Germany's, something that was already there, so
yeah,
you
I was
know,
just
taking
thinking
advantage of it was
you,
a lot
you
easier.
The only reason I brought up hydro is that you were mentioning large power sources, and that's another one. But, of course, that really relies on a lot of things.
It does rely on geography, yeah.
Yeah. So they're trying to booster solar and wind to counteract this shutting down or lessening nuclear?
Yes. And, they're talking about eliminating nuclear altogether.
Wow.
That's their target. And they're looking at just revamping their electrical grid to be able to handle this new type of infrastructure, and they call it the Target Grid 2050.
That's when they think they're going to be done.
And so if you are interested about that, we will be posting that article from The Guardian up on our website.
Great. I want to talk a little bit about security, specifically the...
or the lack thereof.
The lack thereof. There's an iPhone vulnerability that's out in the wild. It's affecting all iOS devices, iPads, iPhones, iPod touches. And this vulnerability has to do with private key, public key authentication, which is the backbone of SSL. When you go to your bank website and it shows a green kind of icon upper left and it has a lock padlock somewhere in your browser, what's happening there is your browser is trusting that the site that it's visiting has been kind of okayed, signed, if you will, digitally signed by a trusted authority.
Imagine you meet someone on the street and they say, "Hi, I have this thing for you." "What? I don't know you." And then a mutual friend of yours says, "Oh no, he's okay.
Right.
You can do that." Then you go, "Okay, then I'll buy that widget from you."
Right.
It's a friend of a friend type of thing. The CAs end up being that trusted friend, so the people that we haven't met already can be
the CA. I don't even know what certificate authority. The CA. Mm-hmm. These are special organizations that have been given the right to make those kind of declarations that these other certificates, these other things that define who we are valid. These online signatures.
Yeah.
Right, so this is a whole signature trust thing that's happening. And these authorities, there's a lot of them. And the way they maintain their strength and validity is by acting in such a way that the people that they sign and vouch for, if you will, are trusted. And there's normally money involved in this. And the browser manufacturers, Internet Explorers, you know, Microsoft's Internet Explorer, Google's Chrome, Apple's Safari, Mozilla's Firefox, all these browsers, and we shouldn't forget Opera, all these browsers actually kind of when you download that browser, you actually get a collection of these certificates that are signed and trusted automatically because they're part of your browser. And
each of the browsers has a slightly different list.
That's right. All the browsers have slightly different lists. And the basic idea is pretty simple. If I've got this signed certificate thing that it can validate some authority online, I know that authority is valid. And then that authority can go ahead and sign anybody else and say, "I trust them." Then if I trust that authority and that authority is trusting the site that I'm visiting, bankofamerica.com, then I can ensure pretty easily that bankofamerica.com is okay for me to visit. It's not some panhandler on the street that happens to have the right computer gear to pretend that they're Bank of America, which is actually very easy to do.
Depends on how you feel about the mortgage crash, but that's another story.
Okay, bad example. Banks are a bad example, of course. Yeah, the problem is you think of any corporation that you want to have a lot of trust with, oddly, there's kind of a backbone inherent antitrust in there too because of the mortgage disaster. But anyway, the technical side of this is all called public key, private key authentication systems. They've gotten the backbone of being able to communicate online. Without these things, the internet's ability for trust is just gone. Because when I go to my bank, which is BayFed, if I go to bayfed.com and I try to initiate a transaction with them, how do I know that that's really my bank and not just some site that's responding that way? And the way that I know that is because they have gone and got their certificate signed and authorized, if you will, by someone that I already trust. Yeah. And that already trust is built into my browsers.
Think of in old war movies where you had secret passcodes. You didn't want to shoot, you know, your friends. And so someone would come up and you'd hear them and you'd say, "Southwest." And the answer would be, "Eagle flies from the north." And then you go like, okay, they're okay.
Even though you don't know each other, you have a secret that you both share and therefore you can trust them.
Right. And this is a little more, it's more complicated
it's really
than that.
Much
but
more
that's,
complicated.
But that's the notion.
You know, it's so complicated that, in fact, that all the geeks that I know, there's only one of them that actually understands mathematics behind this public key, private key. And I've had him on the show before. We won't get into it exactly right now, but just have some faith here on Geek Speak that the public key, private key signing authentication system is very good math. That's the best you can say. So
very large prime numbers.
Very large prime numbers is how it's based on, yeah. I have another story a little bit about digital money, which is going to talk about more about this. But you have to understand that general idea, the public key, private key. What's very clever about this idea, Now, SSL certification is public key, private key, right? It's just on the fly, public key, private key?
The private key is used to sign the mm-hmm. item, and you can use the public key to verify it. And the private key is kept with the CA, for
example. Let's do this transaction like you and I want to talk to each other, okay? And who Dr. Don, who's not here anymore, is the person that we trust. So we both trust Dr. Don. So what happens is I want to know who I'm talking to online. And the person says, I'm Miles. And I go, well, I don't really trust that you're Miles. So I do happen to know Dr. Don. And Dr. Don and I have already handshaked so that I have Dr. Don's information. And Dr. Don's information is this public key. And Miles can get that public key too. And what it can do is this special number. If Dr. Don signs something with her private key, which only she has, we can validate that it was her signature because we have her public key.
Right. She decides what newspaper to use as a key.
Right.
And that's her private key. And then she passes out a thing saying, or whatever thing that we're trying to deal with, and then passes out the code key to say you're looking for the fifth letter, the 12th letter, the 13th letter, and the 17th letter.
The thing that's tricky about this, though, is it's non-reversible. So even if everyone in the world has Dr. Don's public key, her certificate public key, there's no way for us to pretend like we have signed something of hers. We have to have her private key to do that.
Right.
So it's a real, when she then takes Miles's public key, if you will, and signs it with her private key, I can confirm that she's signed it, saying also in the message, yeah, that's Miles. I confirm it with her public key saying, yes, really, Dr. Don's private key, her trusted thing, says that this thing that represents Miles is him. Now Miles and I can communicate together because I can trust him.
I just realized I had a simpler analogy.
I would love
this.
A simple analogy.
Yes, because I realized we're going a little bit too geeky. We're spending too much time in the geek world not going.
Yeah.
You need
we're
to go to
bridging that gap.
Dr. Don, in this case, is our notary public.
Okay.
And she signs off that she saw me
and
make
puts,
this
and puts
page
her seal on it.
And puts her seal on it. And then when I go to Lyle, I say, hey, look at this. And Lyle can go look up and say, oh, yeah, this has been signed by the notary public, a.k.a. Dr. Don.
Yeah.
And here's this other person's signature along with it. And I can verify, okay, the chain is correct. I can trust this person and do business with them because they've been
And then he and
certified.
I can now kind of trust each other. I can trust him. He can give me his public key, and then he can sign stuff and give it to me, and I see it. And I can actually encrypt stuff, make stuff that only he can read using his public key. So the problem with the metaphor
is I can sign stuff with my signature, and then you can verify that it's my signature every single time.
That's right.
You can go back and check to see, that's a valid signature.
So that inherent idea that we can make a secret system where I can publicly share my public key with everyone in the world, which, by the way, it's up on my site, lyle.trox.com. If you want to encrypt things to me, you would go get that public key. You can send me email and encrypt with that public key, and then I can unencrypt it. That whole idea is very important, and it's going to become more and more important as we, I just feel like understanding that public key, private key idea on the online space is kind of like understanding how cash works and credit cards and banking. You have to start understanding the public key, private key stuff if you're going to participate as a non-duped person online. And here's an example of a really bad implementation of this that Apple's just fixed with the most recent patches. So if you've got an iOS device, go and get the update, because it's the very simple idea is this. If in my browser on the iPhone, right now I don't have a patched iPhone yet, my browser will go to a website, and let's say it's bayfed.com. And bayfed.com will say, here's my certificate, and I'll look, and it's signed by someone I trust, and therefore, or it's signed by a certificate of authority, and therefore I can inherently trust that that's really Bayfed. The issue is that if Miles goes and gets Miles's cool certificate.com, and they gets it signed by that same certificate of authority, if I then go to a Bayfed site that is actually not really Bayfed, but something Miles is controlling, and he, with his already authenticated certificate that says Miles is cool, then says this website is valid, the iOS software right now isn't checking to see if he has the ability to sign stuff. They're just checking to see, okay, first off, is this certificate signed? Oh, it's signed by Miles. Okay, is Miles signed by one of the certificate authorities? Yes. Oh, okay, since the chain completes to someone I trust, then everything Miles does is trustworthy. And that's exactly how it's not supposed to work. And they've been doing that since the original iOS. It's been in every version, and it's very, very bad. They're basically not checking to see if the person that signed it is a certificate of authority or just one of their trusted members. And that causes a complete failure of the system that Apple has patched already, and you've got to get the patch to get that worked.
Yeah. Incidentally, this is a prime reason why if you're a web developer or if you're a software developer or whatever, if you do not have a background in cryptography and secure systems, use an off-the-shelf system from someone who does know that. For example, there are many cases where people will go like, oh, I'll just do this quick little patch of OpenSSL to have this.
It's too complicated.
It's too complicated. Unless you know what you're doing, unless you're one of those researchers that's spending the majority of your time trying to refine these systems, you're going to make a mistake.
Yeah. And, you know, this pretext that I just set up, which is concerning, feels, you know, right off the bat, the issue with it, of course, is you have to have a man in the middle attack. If I go and try to go to my
man in the middle attack being an eavesdropper.
Yeah. Yeah. Basically, let's say I go to an internet cafe. Let's say I'm at home and I'm connected to the internet. I use Cruzeo's DSL service, which is provided by AT&T. So I'm at home and I ask for bayfed.com. I'm going to get bayfed.com unless something in between me and bayfed.com is controlled by Miles, right? If he's the hacker. So that isn't very likely in a situation where I'm at home using my ISP. But more and more, we are using Wi-Fi. And Wi-Fi has a few different inherent problems. There's a $30 piece of hardware you can get, which makes a real Wi-Fi point. You connect that to your laptop and then bridge that to another Wi-Fi point. And basically, in a place where you're supposed to have free Wi-Fi, there is free Wi-Fi. It's just provided by a hacker. And this is a very easy thing to do. And then if he then has this certification process that he can do very easily, and you don't have your patch device, you think you're talking to Bayfed, but really you're talking to him, and he is then getting your passwords and everything and contacting to Bayfed, and everything will look totally normal to you. And yet, in reality, they now have your banking information. So it's crucial that SSL, that we trust the certificate, the SSL protocol. And the only way to do that is to make sure that the browsers are all playing fair. I know that's really geeky and technical. Sorry about that. Let's talk about global warming.
No, I actually have a very easy way to describe the man in the middle attack.
Yeah.
You send a letter, and a sealed letter with a stamp on it, we think of that as being a private communication. And someone goes up to your mailbox at your house or breaks into a post office or somewhere in that chain in between you and the destination for your letter. They open the letter. They read that message. And let's say they have someone who is adept at forging someone's handwriting.
Mm-hmm.
They go back. They rewrite another letter, but they change a few things.
Yep.
If it's a love letter, they change it to a letter of hate, or if it's a, you know, they change a few things, or they know that information, they put it into a new envelope, they put a stamp on it that looks like something similar to it, and they assign it in the same way they had before, and they
drive back to the post office that it was first originally sent from, and they send it again.
Right. Yeah. Or redevelop.
This process, I've been trying to explain.
That is a man in the middle attack.
Yeah, I've been trying to explain pretty good privacy, which is the email equivalent of this private key, public key thing. And I was writing this up, and that's the exact analogy I did. You know, two friends mail each other back and forth. And there's a lot of trust inherent in a physical world because, you know, if I use a certain stationery that's like pink and I put some rose water on it, when Miles gets my love letters, he always opens it and he goes, oh, it's this wonderful stationery I like that's got that nice look. And, oh, there's the smell of roses. Oh, and there's the smell of computer dust.
And he always calls me his delicate flower.
And I always call you my delicate flower. So then you know it's from me. There's all these physical clues and even text clues. But once you start doing the digital world, all that stuff just goes away. Now it's just a font, right? And the font's modifiable too. And so the only thing that really defines it has to do with the protocols we communicate with, trusting those, or really trusting that the language is right, that every fifth word is misspelled, then you're going to know it's me. You know, that kind of thing. So this problem is pretty serious in the digital space. We don't get to use all these amazing skills that we have to go, something's fishy here that's in the physical world. That's why people are duped online so much, I think, because all those clues we rely on for trust of people just aren't there.
Security is a very complex thing, and the only way to get people to use something like that is to get it out of your way, to make it transparent.
Yeah.
And when something is transparent, you don't notice if it's not there anymore.
That's right. And that's the, you know, the reason why the browsers in the last 5 years have started making a little green named certificate thing in the browser when you go to secure place is because people weren't paying attention, right? So they wanted to make it more prominent that, yes, you really are the place you're supposed to be at. And the issue with this private key, public key thing that I really want to stress is that if you don't understand it, it's really easy to get duped if you don't start using it. And so I'm pushing for people to start using PGP. But let's talk about global warming, something a lot simpler.
There is an op-ed article in Forbes magazine that was talking about how some new data looking at Earth's atmosphere was allowing for more heat to be released into space, and it wasn't matching up with our current models. So global warming, if those models, if this data was true, if true, then it throws the concept of global warming, the current models for when there be a tipping point or the like, into question.
And this is in Forbes?
Yes, this is an op-ed, op-ed in Forbes.
All right.
The problem with that is that statement of, if true, but that
if
data...
If pigs could fly.
That data doesn't really show that.
So it's not true.
Well, that's the thing. It's... You have a scientist who... and for once, this is actually a scientist. Most of the time, and this is a good test for folks out there to know whether what they're supposed to follow and what they aren't.
Teach me.
If you were talking about theology, mm-hmm. would you ask advice from, you know, your local pastor or rabbi or imam or
a biologist?
Yeah. or would you ask the
your accountant?
Would
your
you ask me?
Or ask Miles, right?
Actually, no, you wouldn't ask someone who hasn't spent a good period of time looking at that. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't, you know, ask advice of that. If you wanted to find out if something was healthy or not, you wouldn't ask the welder.
Right.
You'd ask a doctor. You'd ask a nurse practitioner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the same thing with scientific models, like, or when you're dealing with large systems like climate, like that, you have climate scientists, people who have spent, you know, 10 years in education, higher education, just to get to the point where they can start to contribute.
Right.
And that's who you'd ask to say whether global warming is valid or not, as opposed to someone who is a political wonk or an economist or, you know.
So is the Forbes article written by an economist?
This guy, like I said, for a change, was a scientist. However, he's a scientist who has had his work shown as being thoroughly wrong by every other climate scientist out there.
A bad scientist?
Questionable data gathering.
Okay.
And this is just the message that I wanted to get out there is when you see these messages, look at their credentials, look at their history. And to say that there's this vast conspiracy of climate scientists that are just trying to get funding, one presupposes that you have a bunch of economists and political scientists that make it that are looking for funding. So that same argument works there. But you also have that issue of credibility. And you just have to look at the evidence for both sides and then say, who are the ones who are presenting this? You know, if you're asking about what does the Bible actually say, and you have Joe, who spends his time at the bar, the Pope, you know, various imams in Mecca, you know, things like that, you just have to figure out, there is something to be said for who that authority is that's speaking to it. You don't say that the authority is right just because they're an authority, but you have to look and see, well, on this side, I have, when talking about health issues, I have all these doctors, nurse practitioners, all these people that work with medicine day in, day out. That is their career. That is their mm-hmm. chosen path.
And they have an accepted understanding. It's not like they're all different ideas. There's some ideas that are actually pretty accepted, right?
Right. And then you have a whole bunch of people that are saying, like, no, they're all wrong, and my background is in underwater basket weaving.
You're going to have to go, well, maybe this person doesn't know what they're talking about. But I want to clarify something that I'm concerned about there, that you're it looks like you're making an argument for authority, that because there's a specialist in the area, you should trust them. You're not saying that. You're talking about consensus in a discipline versus outside the discipline. And there is, I mean, there's one
argument to authority would be Obama gets on TV and President Obama says, we should, I'm trying to think of a good example here. We should levy a tax so that bears don't attack people in major metropolitan areas.
Right.
And people would say, like, wait a second, but bears aren't around in major metropolitan areas. They're usually in the woods. Yeah. But it's President Obama who said it.
Right.
That is an appeal to authority, right, saying he have this authority
in
figure
the same,
that says
In the same vein, the reason I bring it up is that you could say, well, you don't want to just trust a climatologist because they're a climatologist. You want to trust that what they're saying is valid scientifically. It's more likely that a giant, large collection of people that study the climate are going to have a consensus this is more close to reality than someone who's not in the field, doesn't understand it, and happens to be a scientist in a different field saying something. If a whole group of these people are saying something different, then you've got to go, well, wait a second. There's a consensus, and then there's an outside idea. And the outside idea doesn't have as much validity as a giant consensus. And if they're claiming kind of a strange claim, a claim that's not what the standard idea is, they have to have really good, they have to have really strong argument for it, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're interested in this topic more, and I'll actually use this as my geek bit today, I've mentioned this before, the podcast called Earth and Environmental Systems Podcast. It's a lecture based on Earth systems by Dr. Christian Shorey. He's of the Colorado School of Mines. Really wonderful thing. I think he has 4 episodes on climate. Talks about what are the stabling values of gases in our system? How does the Earth stay at a relatively the same temperature? Why is it at that temperature? What changes can affect it? Why does carbon dioxide have much more effect on our climate than H2O, even though there's a lot more H2O? Just those ideas. If you're really interested in this topic, I'd highly recommend listening to this podcast. Once you listen to this podcast, you get a much better idea of how complex it actually is. And then next time you hear someone saying, well, because of this, the climate's this way, you understand that actually, wait a second, there's
because
a lot more
solar
factors.
Activity, you know, that type of thing.
Great. Yeah. So I'll have a link to that podcast, Earth Environmental Systems Podcast, after the show. Miles, you got that page? Can I have that page in front of you?
Thanks. Sure.
And you go ahead and do your thing of the day.
Yeah, my geek bit for the day is a fun little bit of math. And that is, have you ever had those times where you wanted to convert from miles to kilometers, kilometers to miles?
Sure.
And you can say like it's 0.6, you know, kilometers to a mile or doing stuff like that. But it turns out that there's yet another way. And this is just so much, this is like a nerdgasm for math folks. You can use the Fibonacci sequence to do that conversion.
Is this coincidental?
Most likely.
Okay, good.
So the Fibonacci sequence is one where you say, okay, let's start off with 1 plus 1.
For that all you art people out there, the golden mean, this is about the Fibonacci sequence.
Yes. So 1 plus 1 equals 2. And then take the previous number, which was 1, and then the number you found next, 2. So 1 plus 2 is 3.
And then take the previous 2 plus 3 is 5.
And 3 plus 5 is 8. And 8 plus 13 is 21. And 21 plus 13 is 44.
You skipped the 5 plus 8 equals 13. But
5 plus
8
equals 13.
Go
sorry.
On. So that's
sorry
the
about
Fibonacci
that.
Sequence, and it goes indefinitely. And it happens to, if you kind of graph this by making right angles, it starts making things like a seashell. That spiral shape of a seashell is actually the diameter that it increases in size in radius change as the Fibonacci sequence.
Yeah, Fibonacci sequence. We see it a lot of places in nature.
Yeah.
And as it turns out, 8 miles equals 13 kilometers. 13 miles equals 21 kilometers.
Awesome.
21 miles, 44 kilometers.
That's weird. Why? That's cool.
Because it just happens to fit within that 0.6 ratio.
It's close enough, right?
And it's not exact. But it's to within 0.5%.
In those smaller kilometers, it works okay.
No. As you get to larger, it's to within 0.5%.
Okay.
Accuracy.
That's not bad. I like it. That's nice and simple.
I mean, as you get into larger numbers, that 0.5% becomes a much larger
Right.
Length, but still.
You don't want to walk that half percent when we're talking about the planets.
But it's a neat little thing. It's just like a little curiosity of math.
Ah, curiosities of math. Hey, speaking of math, are you teaching people math every week? At the beginning of the year, Miles and I both made an annual, what is it called?
New Year's resolution.
New Year's resolution. Mine was to ask more questions and take a photograph every day of a new person. And Miles is to teach math every week or learn a new math thing for himself. If he hasn't done that.
Well.
But I haven't asked you in a while. I'm taking photographs every day of people. If you see me on the street and you recognize me and I haven't taken a photograph of you, please invite me to take a photograph of you. I always need to take pictures of people. It's really frustrating.
It's hard to say. I probably have missed some weeks. At the same time, I've also been working on a project that is...
mathematically cool?
Yeah. So...
You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP. My name's Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Mr. Miles Elam. Answering the phones is Rick. And Rick is waiting for your calls about technology. Any questions you have, a comment you have about what we talked about already, please feel free to give us a call, 1-800-655-5877. Miles, looks like you have something pressing.
Yes. I just wanted to continue on with some crazy science. Before we were talking about just invalid science, the practice thereof. This one is more of the research brand. But it's still kind of, it for me anyway, it has that ick factor. I'm curious as to where it'll go, but it's still kind of ick. Some South Korean researchers have, through genetic manipulation, created a glowing dog.
Nice. Phosphorescent dog.
Yes. Uh-huh. A bioluminescent dog. It'll glow fluorescent green under ultraviolet light if given a specific antibiotic. So it's like you can also turn it on and off in the dog.
Nice. Is there a clap on for a dog injection? In dog glows. Okay, that's crazy, but that's not bad science. It's crazy science.
Yeah, okay. Like I said, it has kind of an ick factor. As an owner, as a you know, someone who has three dogs.
Three non-glowing dogs, I might add.
Yes. It's a little ick.
Yeah.
But it also says that the creation of this, says that the gene injected to make the dog glow can be substituted with genes that may trigger fatal human diseases, for example. And being able to turn those on and off to be able to have control studies would be much easier. And this dog was not bred as we normally do. It's actually done in a form of cloning, somatic cell nuclear transfer, where you take nuclear material, you put it inside of an egg, and then you do artificial fertilization, which has been done with dogs previously. But
yeah, it is harder for us when it's an animal that we can relate to as family. You know, I mean, we've talked about glowing mice for a long time.
Yeah. But then again, like, who wouldn't like the fact that in the summertime, it's fine. You use the antibiotic. And then come wintertime, it starts getting darker earlier. You give them the antibiotic so you can like see them at night so they don't run away from you as easily. Come here, Fluffy.
From Sacramento, Jim, welcome to Geek Speak.
Used to be in Big Sur. Now I'm in Sacramento. And
did you leave Big Sur because of internet connection problems?
I didn't. That's not the reason, although my download speed was about 1,500 kbps.
Yeah.
And my upload was less than that. And it was slow and it was problematic. I left for family reasons, but the advantage of that is that I now have access to Comcast, AT&T, SureWest, whatever I want.
Is SureWest a phone service provider?
It's fiber optic.
Okay.
It's a more local company.
Okay.
Does the triple play, just like Comcast.
Right.
Telephones, internet, TV, although they're expensive. But I can get, if I want to spend the money, I can get 50 megabytes per second up and down.
How?
If I go to SureWest.
Yeah, SureWest, yeah.
Nice.
Even some cable companies will do that for...
I don't want to spend money. So in this process of selecting a new internet provider, I'm calling you guys to say, first thing I want to do that I couldn't do in Big Sur is I want to upload to Carbonite about 250 to 300 gigabytes of photography files.
Okay. First off, Carbonite's an online backup system. There's an application that runs on your computer. It copies your files up. As they change, it copies them up, and it does it in the background, trying not to take your resources. It's very cool because it's an automatic offsite backup. It's under $100 a year for about 50 gigabytes space, I think. So it sounds like it might be the right choice for you. So the issue is that you want to be able to use that service effectively. You couldn't do it in Big Sur.
Yeah.
And all of these service providers, Comcast, AT&T, and SureWest, will work with that system. No problem. It just, the initial upload might take a 2 weeks.
A long time, yeah.
Yeah, a long time. But after that, you're not going to have a problem with any of these.
So that's my question.
Yeah.
What speed, what rate do I need of upload from these providers to be relatively sensible?
Effective.
They will post, or they should be posting their upload speeds as well as their download speeds. It's usually a much smaller print.
No, they'll post it. He's just wondering which one, what's his target? What does he want?
Yeah, because
so here's the thing with Carbonite. You say you have 50 gigs of photos?
I've got about 250 to 300 gigs.
Okay. So the issue is that initial upload. How large does your system grow?
Oh, it'll just keep growing like crazy.
Right, but I mean, are you doing a gigabyte a week or less? Because it comes down, like, pretty much any internet service, if it's an always-on connection, like all of these are going to be, if you leave your computer on all the time, you'll get the uploads you need. Because it's going to throttle you down. And as long as you leave your machine all the time, then you're not going to have a problem. Now, if you want to turn your machine off at night because it's loud and you want to sleep and such like that, then you have to think about the amount of time it's on. And that speed is a pretty clear fraction of this file size, and you can figure it out that way. But what I would do is I wouldn't worry about it. If you're going to get one of these services, all of them are going to provide what you need.
Yeah, but there is an issue, though. I know that Comcast and AT&T both have bandwidth caps.
Yes, they do.
And SureWest I don't know about.
But they probably don't have as drastic a cap as the big guys.
Right.
But those caps are huge, Miles. Those caps are giant. Let's say he's got 250 gigs. It's going to happen once, right? So 1 month it might be a problem. If you've got a laptop, go to an internet cafe place that has high-fat fiber. Like here in Santa Cruz, that Cruz Air actually has a drop-in place where you've got 10 gigabit fiber. You can upload that stuff in a couple hours. And then after that, you're only trickling an amount. But that's a little harder than doing it at home. The next thing is make sure when you sign up for Carbonite that you throttle down to lower than your cutoff. But again, this cutoff is huge. It's not something you're going to have to worry about with 250 gigs.
That's right. That's right. I'm not worried about that. The main thing is, like, the standard upload speed for one of these is 2 or 2.5 megabytes per second. And that'd be okay for me, right? I mean, that would do what I need to do if I take my time.
What is it again?
2.5 megabit, yeah.
Yeah, that's fine. I mean, keep in mind, this first initial upload is going to take a long time.
Sure.
I mean, it's one of those things where you almost want to burn a couple disks and send them to them, because that 250 gigs is just going to take you just a long, even on a fast network, is going to take you some time. So that's the one thing about, you know, what they do, Carbonite normally gives like a month free, something like that. And that month free coincidentally happens to be about how long it takes for you to actually have your backup up there. But also go to a podcast that gets underwritten by Carbonite if you haven't signed up for the service, and do it through them, some podcast you like, right? Because there's a lot of places that they actually get a cut back on, you know, that's how they get fed, if you will, in their podcast. It's not like us where we get no money at all. There's actually podcasts that get some money back, and Carbonite's one of those ones that underwrites. I'm thinking of actually Security Now, which is a lot of the data I've got today's show was because I just started listening to Security Now. Thank you, Brian. And they do the Carbonite thing, which means that if you listen to them and then you sign up for Carbonite, say Security Now, you get 2 months of free service, something like that. I can't remember what it is. But
cool.
Yeah, anyway, I would go ahead and go with the price point that fits you better. And keeping in mind that depending on your service, you can boost that up. Also,
right.
Keep in mind that the DSL up to this speed, up to 6 megabits, doesn't mean that you will get 6 megabits. It actually means pretty much by default you won't get that speed. I would lean toward Comcast as a cable provider, or of course, definitely I would go with this SureWest company if they're as awesome as they sound. Because if they're doing fiber to the house, that's
right, but it's probably going to be a little bit pricier. So you have
probably
to
pricier.
You just have to figure out how much you
the price
you're
is mostly what you're dealing with. In this
willing
point,
to pay, yeah.
All of them are going to make you pretty happy. I would lean towards in a I would go for a local company, so I like the idea of SureWest. Then I'd go for Comcast, then I'd go for an AT&T, but mostly because I pay AT&T a lot of money and I don't like the company very much, so it's always kind of a in my craw kind of thing. Thank you so much, Jim, for calling. And I'm sorry that you moved out of Big Sur, but I'm happy you're still listening to us.
Yeah, okay.
All right, thanks, Jim.
Bye-bye.
From Salinas, we have James. Welcome to Geek Speak.
Hey, guys, how are you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
A pleasure.
Hey, yeah, well, I had a question that I hope that you guys can answer. You know, when I go to on the web, I sometimes go to websites that that I don't necessarily trust, you know, like the big five I trust. But I was wondering, is there a way that when I go to some of these websites, it's kind of flashing for 5 seconds some weird website that's kind of going through to load? Is there a way to capture that so I can kind of review what some of these websites are visiting as it uploads or what it's uploading?
I'm unsure of what you mean by a flashing website underneath. Does it mean that every time you go to a website, there's actually another website that loads first?
Right. So if I go to my website where I have my mail, it's loading up. It flashes at the bottom where what it's doing.
Gotcha. Yes. All the different URLs that it's loading.
So it's almost like a strobe light.
Yeah.
But
you're talking about on the bottom in the information bar, it's giving a whole bunch of URLs of where it's going.
Right. Yeah. But not necessarily where I want to go.
Right. Right. I'll describe what that is for you. This is when we talk about being tracked online and stuff. This is one of the ways it's done. But it's also a very wonderful ability of a browser. So let's say I take some photographs of Miles, and Miles has a website. Do you have a personal website, Miles?
Somewhere.
Okay. Miles isn't as online as me. But let's say Miles wants to take one of my photographs and use it on his website. So I have my photographs up on my website, and he can just link to the photograph itself on my website, not having to incur the costs, if you will, of the download. But also, if I were to sharpen that image and make it a little bit better or put a border around or something, his people that visit his site will still get that same image that I'm serving. The idea is that they visit Miles' site. Miles says, here's my document, and I'm including this document. I want to show you this picture, and this picture happens to be over at Lyle's website. So your browser in the background just goes and gets that thing and puts it up. And that embedding content is really crucial in the way the Internet's designed, if you will. But there's some
side effects.
The World Web is still designed, not the Internet. So
if there's a website that I don't trust, can it be something that I don't want? And there's a way to track what it's
doing? There's ways of doing this. One thing that happens regularly is the ads that show up on a website, if there's an advertising, that's actually almost always served from another company. And the reason for that is so that they can actually track and give back money to the website that's putting the ad up. But because of that, there's these large central ad servers that happen to have a lot of traffic data about you all over the place. And this is the traffic, the tracking stuff that people are always talking about. If you're using a browser that supports plugins like Firefox or Chrome, there are plugins to disable this. In fact, some of them actually are built in. But at the same time, you're going to have less of an exciting web experience if you start disabling these, because then you won't see pictures of Miles on his website, right? And that side effect is actually quite large. So, for example, there's these wonderful JavaScript libraries, one called jQuery, which people use all the time to do really fun stuff online on the pages. And normally they're hosted by one provider. And the reason for that is that you don't need to have a copy on every single website. So Google hosts some jQuery files that GeekSpeak uses. So when you go to GeekSpeak, when you download some of the JavaScript, it's actually coming from Google. And there's a side effect of that we actually get tracking information on our website. And also, it's actually faster for you to use that file because it was already in your browser from a different visit you had. So there's benefits to this stuff. And then, of course, there's privacy concerns as well. I wouldn't go down the rabbit hole of being paranoid, because if you get paranoid, the best thing to do is just turn off the Internet, right? But definitely, the browser plugin I use at Firefox is called Better Privacy. I think that's the, does that sound right? Better Privacy?
I don't know.
Yeah. So yeah, you can do that. The tracking external links and things. The other thing to do is just the websites you use a lot, trust them. The websites that you don't use a lot, you could start filtering. And these plugins will help you. Better Privacy is one.
So I know, like, I use Firefox. So, I mean, you can start private browsing right in Firefox.
Yep.
So does that protect me against websites until I trust them?
So What it does, what a private session does, is it does a couple things. First off, when you turn that private session off, it erases everything you did. So if your mom comes in and looks in your computer, they're no longer the files that you visited. So that's one thing that that does. It also makes a new profile. None of your cookies are enabled. None of it's working. So if you've logged in with Google, for example, and you keep on going through your email and such, and then you turn and then you enable this private surfing, then you're going to have to log in again to Google, right? So there's definite benefits to it. The other thing, the side effect, is if there's an ad servicing company and they're doing a whole bunch of ads on a whole bunch of different sites, so like you're interested in pets, you're interested in dog food and dogs, and you're also interested in scuba diving, the advertising company happens to have ads on both scuba diving sites and pet sites, they know that this person, that is your IP address, if you will, or this browser, happens to be interested in both those things. Let me market something to them that's more specifically about scuba diving on the dog site, maybe. And that information you can disable by turning on these features.
Right. When I go to Amazon, they're not going to have the suggestions.
If you go to Amazon, you don't log in, they're not going to have suggestions. But keep in mind, Amazon, of course, is keeping history of what you've purchased and what you've browsed associated with your account. So every time you go to Amazon, if you want to buy something, you sign in, they know who you are, and they have your complete history. The plugin I'm talking about is called Better Privacy. Good luck. Thanks for calling GeekSpeak. Bye, James. Yeah. All right, from Santa Cruz, Ellen, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hello.
Hi, Ellen.
Yes, I have a question you may have sort of answered already after listening to you.
I probably did it too fast, though, so go ahead and ask again. I probably did it too fast, so go ahead and ask again.
My question is concerning credit card security. And let me tell you what happened. We were just notified by our credit union yesterday that someone had keyed in our credit card number at a restaurant in Minnesota. And it was a Thai restaurant, and lunch was $1,000. And a few minutes later, lunch again was $1,200.
It sounds delicious.
Yes. So they thought something was odd and checked with us.
Yeah, I would think that that's a lot of Thai food in Minnesota.
A lot of Thai food. What the official said to us, and I'm getting to my question, is that she suspected the number had been taken locally, probably from a small restaurant because they don't have very good computer security as well as large companies did. And within the last week, we had gone to several small but local restaurants here in town.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is, how did they get that number? Would it have to be someone here in Santa Cruz, or are they?
Well, first off, do you use your credit card on Sony's PlayStation Network?
No.
Okay, good. That's one way to get it.
Okay.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I guess the bank. See, I love that the bank was able to catch it because it didn't match a pattern that made sense to you because you're not going to Minnesota all the time.
It's a credit union that's really
so
very clever.
The tricky thing with this stuff is that if you go to a small business and you hand a waiter your card and they go ring it in, even if you trust the waiter completely, my iPhone can take really good video, right? If I just aim my video close to the register and surreptitiously do this, right? I can record an hour of people's credit cards going by, and all I have to do is on my computer at home, just pause that image and zoom in and see if I can see the number. If I see the number, I got it. Then I email it to a friend in Minnesota and he buys a really expensive lunch. I mean, it's really that simple. And that's one of those problems with credit cards is that they're these big physical objects that have to be passed around. The only way to...
So you don't think they were actually hacking into the phone line or the picking up...
It's possible that was happening, but it'd be much easier for the waitress to look at it. It'd be much easier for some impression to be made surreptitiously. It'd be much easier to videotape it. Miles, what do you think?
Yeah, I totally agree. It would be much easier to do it by other means. Also, every time you call in someplace and give your credit card number over the phone, that's someone else who has your number. I mean,
right.
Everything is about a certain amount of trust.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, not everyone is trustworthy.
Now, the thing is, if you're a business owner and you listen to GeekSpeak, here's something you can do for your customers, and this is just really a good way to do it. Think about that credit card as a very private thing. We think of them as very nonchalant because they're so easy to pass around, but go ahead and if you're at a restaurant and you have restaurants the billfolds that close, and you put your credit card in that should be provided, And then the person that goes to the register space should pull it out of there in a space that can't be seen very easily by an onlooker, and then keyed into the system without people looking very easily. That will eliminate that very simple path. And the reason I say simple path is, yes, you can also listen in on the keystrokes being hit on the keypad with a recording device. You can also probably tap the phone in just hearing the phone, if it's a phone key call-in thing. Miles?
Rick also posted in a comment, which I like a lot, which is, in UK and in Europe, for restaurants, the credit card never leaves the table. The staff just always brings a portable credit card reader to that table. And that is a much better way than grabbing the card and having it in the pile, the queue of cards to be processed. So there's also
keep in mind, there's someone in that restaurant that's only been working there for a week, and they hate their job. It's always true, right?
So, I mean, there is also an institutional difference between how we do things and how other places do it.
Yeah, because of this. So the question is, do we think it's a technical vulnerability in the credit card system, or modifying a person's actions? It's definitely
inside job.
It's almost definitely modifying a person's actions. And I'm running out of time on GeekSpeak, so we can't get into that further, but thank you so much for listening.
Well, thank you for answering my question.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye.
You can, of course, find out more information about what we talk about on geekspeak.org. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used with permission. Miles, you're going to have a little bit of time at the end to do this really quick 20-second thing. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP, podcasting at KOSP.org. Miles?
And if you didn't catch This American Life this past week, we've talked about software patents on the show before, and I highly recommend you check out the current This American Life
called
When Patents Attack. It does it, unfortunately, better than we ever did. But I highly recommend it. It's very educational.
Yeah, learn about patents. It's a great show.
This American Life, When Patents Attack.
Of course, you can hear it on KOSP. Thanks for listening.